Good evening. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is David McGuire. I'm the director of a nonprofit called Shark Stewards, a project of the Earth Island Institute in Berkeley, and I'm a shark and marine conservationist. I'm very pleased to introduce today's special guest, John Hargrove. As you just saw from the clip from the documentary Blackfish, hosted on CNN and on the web and widely available clips on the internet, in recent interviews on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, which was quite entertaining, and a really great interview on Fresh Air with Dave Davies, you're no doubt familiar with Mr. Hargrove and the issues around orcas in captivity. His career as one of the most experienced orca trainers in the world spanned the course of 2 decades. He worked as a trainer with 20 different whales on 2 different continents and at 2 SeaWorld U.S. parks. John was promoted to the highest level of trainer by SeaWorld, routinely working with captive orcas in and out of the water. After 2 of his fellow trainers were killed by orcas in marine parks, and his own quandary created by witnessing the separation of cow-calf pairs, as we saw in the video clip, and artificial breeding programs in captivity, John says he came to the realization that the enormously successful entertainment programs, such as those at SeaWorld, are not only dangerous for trainers, but also physically and psychologically detrimental to the orcas themselves. His details and all of this are in his provocative new book, Beneath the Surface, Killer Whales, SeaWorld, and the Truth Beyond Blackfish. John resigned from SeaWorld in 2012, soon before the film aired, I believe, but while the film was in progress, and is now a full-time advocate for the humane treatment of orcas. And I might add, he's also been involved with supporting legislation here in California and in New York for orcas' safety and captivity. We can talk a little bit about that in the question and answer. So please welcome John Hargrove. Welcome to San Francisco, John.
Hey guys, thank you very much for having me. This is actually, believe it or not, my first time to be in San Francisco, and I lived in San Diego for almost 8 years, I think. It's maybe 7 years, and then in LA for a year, and I've never been to San Francisco, so it's kind of a weird feeling. Thank you very much. It's a lot better than coming from New York, where it was snowing on the day that I left, but I'll get right into this. So, you know, a lot of people want to know, how did I go from being this 6-year-old little boy that had this dream of being a killer whale trainer, achieving that dream at age 20 in 1993, starting at the SeaWorld of Texas Park, and then I was happy at SeaWorld for many years, and then now I'm here today in front of you and telling you a different story. You know, I faced criticism for that, and I think it's a valid question, and, you know, all I can tell you is how I felt during those different stages of my life, and they were very different. You know, the way I felt as a 6-year-old little boy, seeing a killer whale show at Shamu Stadium for the first time with 5,000 people, the lights, the music, seeing this little bitty trainer in the water with this magnificent killer whale that I'd never seen before, and I was, of course, already an animal lover. I was so seduced by the environment. It just completely, from that day forward, identified me. You know, it was my identity moving forward. And I just, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to have a life with those whales. And it came from a good place, you know. And I think everybody who wants to work with animals, wants to be with animals, I do think that that comes from a good place. But you don't know everything that goes on and everything that happens. And sometimes you have to live it and live through it before you can see it for yourself and then come to that realization. So for me, you know, once I achieved it, started in 1993 and at SeaWorld of Texas, very happy, totally naive, you don't know anything. And I remember growing up in the 70s and 80s, I didn't really think about animals in captivity as being wrong, you know, much less killer whales in captivity. You just looked at Well, certainly they're happy. They look, you know, the trainers love them. They're in these big pools, which you think are big, but you don't realize, you know, how they live naturally in the wild. And you think everything's great, and you think you're going to be this one cohesive group and family and live happily ever after and with the whales. And it's not at all what it appears to be. It's a complete facade. The only thing that I can say is real about SeaWorld is the reciprocal relationship between trainer and whale, trainer and animal, if you're at another stadium. Those relationships are very real, and it's because of those relationships that I have chosen to definitely walk into the fire and speak out, knowing what was coming for me, because I owed it to the whales, because the whales gave me everything. They gave me my childhood dream. They gave me the most amazing experiences that I will cherish for the rest of my life. And my loyalty is to the whales. I was able to leave. I was able to go on with my life. Those whales do not have that choice. They're stuck there in those pools. They had no choice in the matter to be there, where I did. I had the choice to have that dream or not. They were stripped from their families. Many of their family members were killed in the process, and now they're, let's call it what it is, slavery for entertainment and for profit. And the simple fact is that we don't think the same way we do, or we did rather, in the 70s and 80s as we do today in 2015. People have evolved. We evolve on all sorts of social issues, and this is another one of them. Jane Velez Mitchell says, I love it when she said it on one of her programs, this is the emerging social justice of the 21st century. And I think that's exactly right. And, you know, people have been fighting for this cause for decades before Blackfish came out, but they were really restricted to the fringe for whatever reason. You know, you sometimes it's just like the people you see in the subway that are supremely talented, and you think, gosh, if this person knew the right person, they would be a star. But because they don't, they're peddling for money on the subway platform. It's just amazing to see it, like what the right timing and the right people can do. And Blackfish, I think, was just like a perfect storm. It was like it was happening right at the perfect time, you know, and it wasn't the perfect time, of course, because Don and Alexis were killed, but that certainly was a catalyst. People wanted to know more. It was prompting people to really question what was happening. Gabriella Capperthwaite put together this fantastic movie. Unfortunately, she only had 83 minutes to try to put the whole history of it in there. So my goal in writing the book was, I didn't set out to do a tell-all book against SeaWorld. I set out to just give a very factual document of my 14 years in the industry spread out over a 19-year period of what it was like to be a killer whale trainer, all the high points and all the low points. I wanted to put it all in there. And but as the book got written and rewritten and rewritten, you know, I think we did 10 rewrites at the end of it, but there were so many low points and so many damaging things that happened to the whales and us as trainers that it definitely became a tell-all book naturally. So certainly SeaWorld does not want people to know what's inside the book, and they've gone to great measures to try to stop that. But I'm not going to let that silence me. I know SeaWorld very well. I know how they work. Being at Shamu for so many years has conditioned me to have a very thick skin, so I am prepared. But what I want to do is I want to do this in kind of two ways. I want to give you a high point, and I want to give you a low point. And a high point are that really shows off the relationship that we have with these animals, how amazing their intelligence is, their awareness, their social skills. And then I want to give a low point where that I will actually read from the book, and it was the day that Don was killed and those details. So for the first part, I don't need to read it. It's a story about Takara. You heard me speaking about Takara and her mother Kasaka when they were separated in 2004. And, you know, what SeaWorld has even said about that separation, as they said, you know, this is where SeaWorld's brilliant at the spin. You know, you have to just read between the lines or keep it going. I remember when they first put out the video about that separation, it was that, well, Takara was 12 when we separated her from her mother, Kasaka, and we even sent her with her own daughter, Kohana, Well, what they didn't tell you, it stopped right there. What they didn't finish telling you was the whole story. It was that once Kohana and Takara were shipped off to Florida, which was still a traumatic event for Takara and Kasaka, mother and daughter, who were inseparable, to be, ripped apart. But they soon took Kohana from Takara when she was only 3 years old and sent her to Spain. So at 3 years old, sent to Spain with no mother and with no other adult female to help her or to learn from, she was inbred by her uncle, Quito, who later killed Alexis Martinez. He inbred Kohana twice. She rejected both of the calves, and the second calf died within its first year. She simply did not know what to do. And it's equivalent to a junior high. We hear these stories sometimes with people. A junior high girl gets pregnant. She's scared. She doesn't know what to do. You find the baby in the trash can and the bathroom. And it's a horrific story. But we hear those stories. It's the same thing in Killer Whales. They have to be taught to be good mothers. And she had nobody. And so, that was very disturbing. And then, of course, then they bred Takara again. She had Trua. Trua was 3 years old when they took Takara from Trua and moved her, transported her to Texas. So now she's gotten separated from her mother, her first calf, Kohana at age three, now Trua at age three. And while they transported her, she was 7 months pregnant with Sakari. So imagine just all the trauma and the stress involved in that. And Takara was the most valuable relationship in my career. I loved all the whales, but I had an enormous history with her. And there was an incident I had with her where I broke my ribs. And it wasn't her fault. It wasn't aggressive. I was doing a stand on Spy Hop, and my foot slipped off her rostrum right as we were about to break the surface. So we've been down on the bottom of the pool 36 feet. As soon as she clears her fluke, she kicks it in full speed so she can propel her body fully, like her entire length above the surface of the water with me standing on top of her. So she's going about 25, 30 miles per hour, and my foot slipped off right as we were breaking the surface. So as soon as that foot slipped off, it caused me to lean forward. And when I leaned forward, she was coming up with that speed. So 5,000 pounds with her rostrum just hit me right in the ribs. So, of course, it spun me like a rag doll and knocked the breath out of me. And she immediately, and this is the good part of the story, she immediately started sharking around me, and we call it sharking, what that is. They're circling you in a perimeter around you with their dorsal fin completely exposed, and she's echolocating on me the entire time. And the echolocation is something that you can hear and you can also feel it. You can feel it in your rib cage mostly, but you can feel it everywhere. And by doing their echolocation, they can actually perform basically like what's like an ultrasound. They can see inside your body. They can see what's happened. So she knew I was hurt. And she was also making vocalizations that are consistent when they're concerned, like concerned about, something like that, an injury happening or something in their social structure. So she was emitting these concerned vocalizations. She was echolocating on me. I was trying to get my wind, get my breath back, but I knew I was hurt, and I knew there was no way I could swim out of the pool, and I needed her to take me out of the pool. She finally came up to me. I put both of my hands on her rostrum. At that point, she was still making concerned vocalizations, but she quieted down as soon as I put my hands on her, but she still kept echolocating all on me. And then I stuck both of my feet out, and I asked for a pec push, and that's when each one of her pectoral flippers will hit each one of my feet, and then I can steer her wherever I want to go. And one of the things I loved about Takara was her personality. She was such a rough ride. She was dominant. She was in charge of the whole social structure. And to swim with her, she had just incredible power and speed. And she did not hang back for you, basically. She had definitely had the mentality of, you better be able to handle this, because if you can't, then tough luck, Too bad for you. I'm going on. And I love that about her. I just loved how she's like, well, you better be able to handle it. So, but this time when I asked for the pec push, Sometimes she would hit my feet hard enough, or one time she even knocked me out of alignment, my back, just to show you. Because imagine, she's 5,000 pounds. So when she's hitting you, even what would seem like something like a simple behavior, 5,000 pounds hitting your feet like that, and especially in a jarring motion, if you're not perfectly aligned, can easily knock you out of alignment. So that had happened to me with her before because she's so rough. But in this situation, I stuck my feet out, and I never even felt her pecs touch my feet. And I'm just swimming in black men's dress socks. So, and I never even felt it at all. And all I knew is that I was just suddenly being, you know, glided back, pushed into the back pool from the front show pool. And then when we got to the back, she needed to give me a pec step off. Most of the time, she'll just throw you out of the pool, where you just, you literally do like one of those little hurdles over the wall that's elevated. And if you clip your toe, then you've got a spectacular smash that's pretty funny if it don't get hurt. But in this situation, she took her time. She went down very slow, very deep. She rose up very high where her pecs were completely above the surface of the water. So all that I had to do was just take the smallest step, and I was off her pec. Because at that point, I've had to turn around, and now I just have 1 foot on one of her pecs and my arms around her rostrum. So as she lifted me up, all I had to do is just take that one smallest step, which is really all my body could do at that point, to get out of the pool. What's fascinating about this story is that this isn't something that is taught. We didn't teach her that. That was not her criteria. She was not rewarded to give me that type of criteria in that situation. So this was a judgment that she made based off of the situation, and a decision that she made because she knew what was going on. So it just really shines on the intelligence and the awareness of these animals and the relationship. So that's the good story, and how much I love her and miss her. And like I said, I love all the whales, but Takara definitely is the relationship that I value the most of my career. Now here's the dark story, and this is kind of difficult to listen to, but I think it's important for people to hear it, because it's the truth, and people haven't always received the truth. They often don't receive the truth from SeaWorld, and this is really what went down that day when Dawn died. So at the day that Dawn was killed, I was at the Texas park. I was training killer whales in the back when all the supervisors, up more than supervisors, very high level management came into the back gate. We knew something was wrong, and they pulled us all in the office and said, "There's been a trainer death in Florida," and I think it was me that asked who it was, and he said it's Dawn with Tillicum. I couldn't believe it. I'd known Dawn for 9 years, so but they were very tight lipped even with us about what went on, how the rescue effort played out, everything. They were very tight-lipped. Normally, we have a corporate incident report. They did not generate a corporate incident report for Dawn. They did not let us watch the video of Dawn, where we did analyze the video when Alexis Martinez was killed 60 days earlier, and there was a full corporate incident report on that. So there were already, because of the media and because of the OSHA investigation, they were already in full legal mode of protection, and they knew the more people that read a corporate incident report or saw a video, those were more people that could be deposed and asked to testify in court to what they saw. And they definitely had an image to portray and a lot to hide. So I'm going to just start reading. I get more of the inside story after I visited the Florida facility in December 2011. Every year, each park in the SeaWorld system tries to send one trainer to one of the other facilities. It wasn't really to learn from each other, as evident from the way Lindsay and I argued over behavior protocols in Antibes. San Diego, San Antonio, and Orlando were all very much set in their ways, but it was a chance to get to see what the differences were and a chance to network. I'd get into a wetsuit and be on stage and poolside, watching how the trainers interacted with the whales during sessions and shows. Being in Orlando also gave me a chance to see how the park was dealing with Tillicum and the aftermath of Dawn's death. As a member of the Big SeaWorld family, even though we weren't really a family, I met some of the Florida trainers before. In fact, I'd known some of them for years. As the week of my visit went by, I would hear about what happened on the day as they tried to rescue Don. The one story that moved me the most involved a highly experienced trainer named Lars Cervik, and it reflects what I believe about trainers and whales having a bond that not even tragedy can break. Laura is probably the most experienced and knowledgeable orca trainer in SeaWorld, with 24 years of experience at Shamu Stadium. She had worked with Tillicum when he arrived in Florida in January 1992 and knew him better than anyone else. But as the result of a promotion to become the second highest ranking animal curator in Orlando, Laura had been reassigned to Dolphin Stadium at the end of 2009. So just a couple of months before Don and Alexis were killed, both Laura Cervik and another high-ranking trainer, Liz Morris, were moved out of Shamu and moved to Dolphin. Laura and Don were best friends. They wore rings to signify the strength of that friendship. But February 24, 2010 would bring two of the most important beings in Laura's life in fatal conflict. It was like having a good friend kill an even better friend. Laura was at work on her side of the Marine Park at Dolphin Stadium, and she was on the phone with Kelly Flaherty Clark, the animal training curator, who essentially took the job of curator at Shamu Stadium, and that's what caused the move of Laura to Dolphin. So when Kelly told Laura on the phone that she had just been told by Dan Brown, the park's president, that the emergency alarm systems had gone off at Shamu Stadium. Laura looked at her husband, Mike, a supervisor at Sea Lion Stadium, and said, "I've got to go now." She drove to Shamu across the compound, and it was chaos when she got there. "Who is it?" she shouted to the crowd that had gathered. "Tillicum and Don," came the response. "He has Don." Laura ran to the platform at the Dine with Shamu pool. Tillicum had Don in his mouth. Laura recalled that Don's hair was missing. She saw that the trainers were deploying the net to try to force Tillicum from one pool into another so that they could finally get him to a med pool with a lifting floor. Her heart was racing. She didn't know whether Don was dead or alive. The trainers were able to move Tillicum into a med pool, but it was one without a lifting floor, and so they had to move him on through the linked pool. So he ultimately had to be forced by deployment of the net through three pools until they could get him into a pool that had a lifting station where they could completely beach him and ultimately get her away from him. So, as she later told a detective of the Orlando Sheriff's Office in a taped conversation that has been made public, "My first thought was I was very mad that we didn't have that lift station. Because of this animal, we know he's killed two other people." At that point, she still didn't know if Don was dead. She was still in Tillicum's jaws. Laura began to pray about what to do next. Laura saw Shamu supervisor Jenny Mayo being comforted by her husband. She walked over to hug Jenny, who said, "She's gone, Laura. She's gone." At that point, Laura turned and thought for a moment, and another trainer approached her and said, "It seems as though we're exacerbating it." And Laura agreed, "Yes, you're right. Let's just calm down, and I will get to Kelly." She asked Kelly Flaherty Clark, SeaWorld Orlando's curator of animal training, if she could tell everyone to just back off. "She's already gone, and we don't want him to mangle her body. She wanted to preserve the dignity of the friend she loved." After Clark ordered off the rescuers, Tillicum appeared to relax a bit. Laura then went into the locker room, removed her street clothes, and put on a wetsuit. "I had made the decision," she later told a detective of the Orlando Sheriff's Office in the taped conversation, "I'm getting that body. I'm getting my friend." Her advantage was her years-long relationship with Tillicum. "He knows me," she told the detective. The orca was finally at a pool with a lift station, and Laura waited for the floor to lift him up, essentially beaching him. She stepped onto the platform, and this is what's important here. This is at a time when you can imagine what this scene must have looked like, and people were viewing Tillicum as a complete monster. And Don, and I'm sorry, I keep saying Don. Laura had the strength of character to step over that wall and be face to face with Tillicum and to get her friend back. And it just says so much. And it's very powerful when everyone was looking at him as a monster. She looked at Tillicum, Well, first, she stepped onto the platform and made eye contact with the whale who had her friend in his mouth, shaking the body back and forth. The rescuers who were there and told me about, who were actually part of deploying the net and pulling him, forcing him into the pool, said that he was shaking her with such force in his mouth that parts of her body were coming off. So, she looked at Tilikum again, right into his eyes, and said in a strong voice, "It's all right, baby. Settle down." She knelt and cradled Don's torso while Tilikum still had her in his jaws. "It's all right. Let go," she told him. "Just let go." Tilikum seemed to be responding. The rescuers were once again trying to get a net over Tilikum's head. They had already draped one over his body. "He almost let her go," Laura told them. "Just tuck it around his rostrum and he'll let go." They did, and she was able to extricate her friend. She now focused all her attention on Don, looking at her face and bringing the body to a place where no one could gawk as they cut the wetsuit away and tried in vain to use the defibrillator to bring her back. The rescuers realized that Don's left arm had been torn off, but managed to reopen Tilikum's mouth to retrieve it. Don's sister ring, identical to the one she shared with Laura, was on the hand of that arm. After calling Don's husband Scott with the news, Laura tried to help Kelly Flaherty Clark move Tilikum from the med pool to isolate him in a back pool once the mechanical lift was lowered. Still in her wetsuit, Laura took a bucket of fish and tried to convince the orca to move into another pool. And when she's doing this, she's encouraging him. So she's asking for simple behaviors, and when he's doing those simple behaviors correctly, she's bridging him. She's letting him know he's correct and being like, "Good boy, yes, you can do it," and then trying to go for the separation. So, you know, when an animal doesn't want to do something, you first want to try to get him on going in a positive direction, and then hopefully you can get your target behavior that you know that they're showing resistance to. So that's what she's doing here. So she's saying he appeared to respond to some of the signals. "Good boy, okay, you ready?" she asked. She slapped the water on the far side to try to get him to move. He looked as if he might, but ultimately he refused to leave the med pool area. Laura said it was because he could see that Don was still nearby, her body covered in a black blanket only a few feet away from Tilikum on the other side of the wall. "He knew she was there," she told the detective on tape. "That was his possession. Don't try to take that away." Now, I just want to just bring back to what ultimately happened to her, that hurt the result. So these are details that, by the way, that management never communicated to us. I had to learn this from people who were part of the rescue efforts, other trainers. Tilikum struck Dawn several times with his head, seizing her in his mouth as he dragged her under, swimming around beneath the surface with her in his jaws. He had her at various moments by her arm, by the neck and shoulder area, by her hair, and by her leg. By the end, she had been scalped, her spinal cord was severed, her ribs were broken, and her left arm had been completely torn off. And all her remaining limbs were dislocated. And now, this entire time, Tilikum emitted highly upset vocalizations, highly aggressive vocalizations. He refused every attempt to be emergency recalled over so they could try to rescue Don. And to this day, SeaWorld still says Tilikum did not attack Don. That he was, and their expert witness in the OSHA hearings blamed Don, and he said the only thing that led to this event was a mistake by Miss Branshaw. And he went further to say he was never aggressive with Miss Branshaw. He was simply controlling her movements and not allowing her to surface. But I'm sorry, but that's not what I just read you. So, not at all. And the judge didn't buy it either. When SeaWorld testified in the OSHA hearings, they testified, and this is what people ask me, well, how did I get to where I am today? So, how did I go from being this 100% loyalist, defending SeaWorld, to where I am now? A lot of things have been building in me. The most important one that really started it all was seeing that they were treating these whales like baby machines. Once we started doing the artificial insemination beginning in the year 2000, which I was a part of, and I initially thought was a fantastic thing, we were the first ones in the world to do it. By the end, it was something I dreaded, I fought, I tried to prevent them from doing it, and I was with Takara in 2011 when she was being artificially inseminated, and I was in control of her for that procedure. I would just remember holding her pec and looking at her eye and just telling her how sorry I was that I couldn't stop it. I tried to stop it, but I couldn't. And, you know, to know that they were forcing this 18-month gestation period on her again, and they were most likely just going to strip another one of her calves away from her. So the mother-calf separations, the forced artificial inseminations, these are things that I really started to fight with management. Then later, the continued use of putting our killer whales, some that are 21 feet in length, into a pool that's only 8 feet deep. I fought that as far as when I initially raised all kinds of, I can't use those words. I raised all kinds of heck over on that issue and thought that people were going to listen to me, like, yeah, that's not right and we shouldn't do it. And we were keeping whales in that 8 foot deep med pool for sometimes up to hours at a time. They're just floating motionless up to hours at a time. So when nothing happened, when I couldn't win that battle, I called the curator, told him this is not right. This has got to stop. Nothing happened. Nothing changed. I got the politically correct answer. So then I sent an email to the general manager of the park, and I said, is this even, I'm questioning this, the legality of this under the Animal Welfare Act. You can imagine how well that went over. So, because I was already known as a troublemaker at that point, because every day I was fighting them. I was fighting them saying, this is not right. We can't do this to her. We can't take another baby from her. We can't force another artificial insemination. We can't, you know, make these whales do 7 shows today and, you know, cut back on their food. You know, so I was just every day fighting them. So not only did I not get an email response back, but within 5 minutes, a curator showed up at Shamu, pulled me aside and said, this is a quote, what in the hell do you think you're doing? Do not send emails like that. And I knew that's the reaction I was going to get, but that's what I wanted. I wanted to shake the cage. I wanted to let them know, I know I'm not stupid and I have a brain and I am questioning the way that these whales are being treated. I wanted to let them know. And they knew that. They knew I was dangerous because of the knowledge that I had, and I wasn't happy. So I remember even being told at the end that, you know, I better not leave and speak out, because if I do, I was going to hurt the whales. And that was a psychological attempt on their part, because, of course, I didn't want to hurt the whales, you know. And then it made me think in my mind and stop and think, am I going to be hurting these whales by speaking out? But I was able to, a very cult-like mentality, I was able to process through that and realize, look, I've tried for years to change these things from the inside, and I couldn't do it. The only hope to try to change these things is to leave and to speak out and to tell the truth of what I know. So the things that led to my departure all happened all at the same time. I broke my ribs on Takara, which that wasn't, you know, even though, yes, it was bad, I didn't view it as bad, because actually it was a very heartwarming moment the way Takara treated me. But that put me out of commission for a month. I came back. We were swimming. But 2 months later, Keto killed Alexis. And I used to work and swim with Keto when he was in the California park before he was moved. And then 60 days later is when Tillicum killed Don. But it wasn't as horrific as that was. It was the way SeaWorld handled it. They chose to completely sweep under the rug that Alexis was killed by Keto, even though those were our whales. We owned them at the time. We still own them now. But SeaWorld, and we had a SeaWorld supervisor there at all times, especially for water work. But SeaWorld immediately tried to distance themselves from that park. And because there was no media, it happened during a training session, so there was no public and no media, it was swept right under the rug. And they kept it swept under the rug until Don was killed, because the media was involved in that. And then that got people digging, and they were like, wait a second, another trainer just 60 days earlier was killed. And people still didn't connect the dots, because they thought it was just a European park. They didn't realize that those were SeaWorld whales and SeaWorld trained and SeaWorld supervised, which SeaWorld did not want people to connect those dots. So then I thought it was incredibly disrespectful that they gave Alexis no attention, nothing, and just swept that up. I personally was swimming back in the water with whales 2 days after Alexis was killed, and we still didn't even know what had happened to him yet. It took about 3 weeks before we would get details of his death. Now, when Dom was killed, they pulled us out of the water, and Jim Acheson, who thankfully is no longer the CEO, he gave this, you know, great little speech about to the press. How we're so sad, and we're such a family, and this and that, and we're pulled our trainers out of the water for safety as we reevaluate our safety procedures to see what, if anything, we need to change. Well, then why wouldn't you have pulled us out of the water 60 days earlier when Keto killed Alexis? You know, it was just a publicity thing. You know, now he had to say that because the cameras were on. So I was very offended by that. And then the final kick in the gut for me was when they testified in the OSHA hearings that they had no knowledge we had a dangerous job. And I still, believe it or not, even with fighting with management all the way up to the end, I still naively believed that if something horrific happened to me that day, like if 2R were to kill me that day, that they would defend me and protect me for all the years that I put myself at risk for that company. But when I saw them in court say we had no idea it was dangerous for them to swim with killer whales, interact in close proximity with killer whales, it just, something inside me died. All the passion died, all the respect that I had for them died, because how could I not look at what happened to Don and Alexis and not see myself? This is exactly what they would do to me if I were to be killed today. So that's when everything changed, and I was battling injuries. My doctors had been trying to get me to quit for 3 years. I was getting hyaluronic acid injections in both knees from torn cartilage. I went on medical leave in May of 2012 and then resigned 3 months later in August of 2012. And then 7 days later, I gave my interview for Blackfish. So what you saw on the screen was 7 days fresh out of resigning from SeaWorld. So I was a little nervous. And I just wanted to conclude, because I probably have gone over. I should have been watching the clock. I'm a little long-winded. But I just wanted to let people know where we are today. Conservative estimates now put Blackfish viewership at around 150 million people have viewed it worldwide. 150 million people. We have historic legislation pending here in this great state, which we're an interim study. I testified before the California State Assembly with Dr. Deborah Giles and Dr. Naomi Rose last year. We should be testifying again for it coming up again in one more year. I fully expect it to pass. Carol Ray, who also starred in Blackfish, very, very great lady. She testified for Washington, so that legislation is pending in Washington. And then I helped Republican Senator Greg Ball with his Blackfish bill, which was more, there's no killer whales in New York State, but it was more symbolic that, you know, we will never tolerate having killer whales captive in our state, and it passed unanimously in the Senate. So, historic, amazing things are happening. Everybody knows what happened with Ringling Brothers. I mean, for Ringling Brothers, which I never would have thought I would have seen in my lifetime, 145 years old, more money than God to come. I never would have thought they would have released their elephants. And for them to say, and quote, that this is because a shift in what our consumers want and animal welfare, that we're retiring all of our elephants to an elephant sanctuary by the year 2018. I mean, this is just more egg in the face of SeaWorld, that now a circus is more progressive than they are on animal rights. It's pretty disgusting. So they used to have the power. We have the power now. And it's because, not just because of us that have participated in Blackfish or people like me have spoken out, but all of us in this room who are passionate about this cause, who believe in what these animals deserve, something that we had no right to ever take from them, even in the beginning. And, we are winning. We're going to win this. It is only a matter of time, and SeaWorld knows it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Our thanks to John Hargrove, former whale trainer at SeaWorld, featured in the documentary film Blackfish, which aired last year on CNN. and author of the new book, Beneath the Surface, Killer Whales, SeaWorld, and the Truth Beyond, Blackfish. It's time for today's audience question period, and we have a number of questions, a lot. So thank you. And since this is San Francisco, I put it out there on Twitter today and got a lot of Twitter tweets, that is. And we won't address all of them. There's been a bit of a tweet fest. There's actually been a lot of social media around this issue in particular, but John's book as well. But it's very interesting to see how this has evolved in the platform and where this dialogue has gone. I think what strikes me and strikes us all is the gravity, the emotional aspect with the connection of the whales, and the compassion. And when I hear you speak, and I've been going through a lot of your interviews, and I read the book, and there's a lot of love in there and a lot of compassion, and it's almost like a bad breakup, where it's denial, and you hate to leave, and there's this whole turmoil. And that comes across in the book as well as some of the beauty of the relationship you had. So it wasn't all such serious physicality, shall we say. Yes. But I wanted to kind of bring back that something that you alluded to, and I'll start off that with a question that was, this was a long tweet, so it actually, but to summarize it, SeaWorld's Dr. Christopher Dold, who is the chief veterinarian, and Chuck Tompkins, who's the zoological manager, I believe, he's one of the spokespersons for SeaWorld, really have distanced themselves from not only what they said about Don's incident at the beginning, but also some of the statements that you make in the book, and they call it your interpretation and exaggeration and a lot of discounting, and they're really launching a very serious social media and marketing campaign very effectively. Well, I don't know how effectively, but they're putting a lot of money and a lot of effort into it. So I would like to just ask you, rather than just discount that or refute it, why don't you give us an example of your experience? You write in the prologue to the book about your experience with Freya and a whale that you were very close to and had a close call with.
You want to know about the Freya incident? So I had, I think, 10 major waterwork aggressions in my career where whales had grabbed me in their mouth and pulled me under. And what's interesting about when something like that happens, you would think that we would be very panicked and be like, okay, this apex predator has me, and when are they going to bring me up to breathe? But you don't. At least for those of us that were very experienced, we all had the same similar reaction. It hurts your feelings. Like as you're being drugged down, you're like, I can't believe you're doing this to me. Like, why are you upset? Like, you're not even concerned or thinking about when you're going to be brought to the surface to take a breath. And it's also a belief system in that relationship that you're going to be able to work through it. And that was one of the hardest things. I'm sorry, I'm getting off on a tangent. But it was one of the hardest things that I had to accept about Dawn. It was that I had a hard time accepting that she couldn't find a way to work through it with Tillicum because of her relationship with him. And I think really what it was because it became such chaos with all the emergency alarms going off, and it just became, once it became so frenzied like that, then he just went into, you know, almost like two people fighting and then just tunnel vision, you can't see anything else. But I often wonder if it had not been such a frenzied situation, would she have been able to work him through it behaviorally? So with Freya, though, that was the only waterwork incident in my career that truly unnerved me, that I really thought in my mind, I remember thinking, I might not make it out of this pool. And I was 27 at the time, and I was like, I don't want to die in this pool in the south of France, not like this, not at 27. And the reason why is because those whales had never had trainers in the water with them before. And it was just me and another SeaWorld trainer that went over there. So we were the first ones in the world getting in the water with these whales. So we knew we were going to have aggressions. And Freya was dominant. She was the matriarch. She was about 7,000 pounds, huge. And, you know, she could be scary. And I'd been swimming with her son Val in another pool. I ultimately got control of Freya. I dove into her pool. She did not like the fact that I had been swimming with her son Val, which I did not interpret at the time. I thought that I interpreted her at the gate really watching the session as wanting to be part of it. Later, I would learn that she had this jealousy issue, that she would displace other whales if you tried to work her with multiple whales at the same time. She would physically displace them. She only just wanted to look, you're just working with me. So she did not like the fact that I was just swimming with another whale. I don't think it had anything to do with it being her son. It could have been any whale. And now I was in her pool. So she, long story short, she grabbed me by my waist and drug me under twice. I ultimately was able to get her to bring me out of the pool and bring me to safety. At one point, she took an emergency recall that I asked for, and after she had already drugged me under, and all the French trainers around expected me to just frantically try to swim out of the pool. But I could see Freya's eyes, and even though she had chinned up at the control trainer, her eyes were still rolled back looking at where I was. And I knew if I made even the slightest motion to try to swim out, she was going to come and get me. And there was no way you can beat her. There's just no way to even try it. And the aggression would just escalate. So I told the French trainer to point her back to me. And they were just in shock. They were like, quoi? And I was like, point her back. Like, don't make me repeat myself right now. Like, because if she splits, it's going to be even worse. So she came back to me. She was totally calm. And as she was coming back to me, I swam to right in the dead center of the pool. Because I wanted to show her, Freya, I'm not trying to get away. I'm in your domain. This is your control. You're calling the shots. I'm not going to try to compete with you. So, and I think that switched it for her. And she came back. She was calm. I asked her for three simple behaviors. She did all three correctly. And then I asked her for a peck push to the side of the stage. She was completely calm, gave me the peck push. I stepped off. The only remaining food was about 15 pounds left. I fed her all 15 pounds, bridged her, walked away, but my knees were shaking. And but then what happened after that is Freya and I went on to have the strongest relationship, and I loved her so much and had the most amazing experiences with her, and I never had another aggression with her. But it was about learning what happened in that aggression and then trying to, you know, get a hold of it, you know. So that's one of the things that I loved about animal training was the psychology of it, is figuring it out behaviorally. Like what this animal needs and likes and dislikes and how you're going to reach what you're hoping to accomplish.
Well, there was a similar incident in the film. Was it Ted Peters?
I call him Petey. His nickname's Petey, but Ken Peters.
Ken Peters, where he was dragged down. And I was really impressed by the calm that he showed. Rather than panicking, he stroked the whale. He was gasping for breath. Mm-hmm. And then he was able to gain control and get away when he could. And you look at the power of those animals, it's remarkable. So maintaining that composure under pressure like that is quite extraordinary. But so one of the questions were, several actually, it's what do you think caused this? I mean, you said that the son or the mother of the whale that you were swimming with in France, but there obviously Tilikum has killed trainers, and there have other been, in the OSHA hearings it came out there, something like 70 incidents, and that's, the judge thought it was an understatement.
It was.
That there were many violent or near misses or signs of aggression, which SeaWorld in public, at least as a spokesman, denied that orcas are aggressive. So there have been three questions here. Why do you think the whales are so aggressive to the point of actual violence like that?
Well, I think that, you know, just the nature of the animal in general, they are killer whales. You know, they are an apex predator. But aside from that, I think that when you're in confinement and you're in these ridiculously small-sized pools and day in and day out, and this other species is controlling everything that is your food and when you get to eat and when you get to go in with another, I think the stress levels build. And as that stress builds, then you have a greater potential for aggression. For sure. And every situation is different. Every aggression is different. You know, so it depends on the circumstances. But captivity absolutely leads to frustration. And that frustration then leads to aggression. So, and so that's why I think that you see, you know, why aren't people being attacked then in the wild, and out in their natural habitat? But we're having deaths at SeaWorld. And I just think their stress levels are through the roof. We even medically treat them for that. They have ulcers, and we treat them with Tagamet because they're They have chronic stress and they get ulcers. So, you know, many of the whales are on medications. Some whales I've worked with were on medications every single day of their life, and all caused by conditions from captivity. But what was the other question?
I think you answered him. It was why are the whales aggressive? Why do they kill people in captivity?
Oh, I know what I wanted to say.
What induced Tillicum in particular.
Because in the OSHA hearings, because SeaWorld turned over 100 aggressive incident reports since 1988, which they had to then admit on stand that they, quote, missed a few after they were cross-examined and said, what about this incident that happened that's not in your 100 list? And what about this one? And what about this one? I think they brought up like four. And and Chuck Tompkins on the stand said, well, we missed a few. And I can tell you personally from looking at that list, they missed more than a few. And the ones that they listed were severely downplayed. And what's interesting is that they got OSHA to go just accept from 1988 on. And I always wondered, why did they choose that random year, 1988? Like, why didn't they just ask and pull for all the aggressions? Well, SeaWorld had convinced OSHA, like, is it okay? Look, we'll go back all the way to 88 and give you all the aggressions. Well, obviously, that sounds like a long period of time. But if they would have gone back just one more year to 1987, we had three near fatalities. Three different trainers were nearly killed, Joanne Weber, Jonathan Smith, and John Sillick. And all three trainers sued, all three trainers for negligence. All three trainers were forced into settlement, and all three trainers were gag ordered, and SeaWorld did not want that year examined.
So that's a good segue to a follow-up, which is to paraphrase about four questions that are very similar. About the trainers that were gag ordered, why weren't you gag ordered? And are you in contact with any of the trainers that are still working at SeaWorld? And have you had any, or will you be able to have any contact with the animals that you've been so close to?
Oh, that's tough. That's a tough one at the end. You know, let me start. I'll go backwards. Contact with the animals there, for me and for my own sanity, I just treated it as a death. I mean, I had to. I mean, I don't ever want to go back. I have no desire to go back and look at Takara from a, one, I wouldn't want to be a patron of SeaWorld. I certainly wouldn't give them my money. And, you know, secondly, I wouldn't, after the life I shared with those whales and, watching them give birth and helping them with their babies, taking the placenta out of just the most amazing, unbelievable memories to be then reduced to a park guest, and what a park guest would see and experience in the stands would be incredibly painful for me. And I'm okay with looking at all the old footage. I have a ton of it, pictures and video of me with the whales, and it's fine. It doesn't upset me. But if I see something new, I don't like to see it. I quickly will move off of it. I don't want to see a new picture of Takara or a new video of Takara. But I do have contact with some trainers at all three parks, but they have to keep it secret because of the retribution that they would receive from management. So they secretly cheer me on and root for me. And then, of course, though, a lot of them hate my guts and wish I was dead. So, and I knew that was going to happen when I made that choice. But, it was a choice that I made knowing that I would lose those people. Some of them, it didn't really matter to me much. Some, it mattered a lot. I loved them, but I knew I was going to lose them in this process. And there was only one surprise. Everybody else I had predicted accurately, and there was only one surprise, one shocker that hurt. And it was my best friend of 20 years, and she sold me out the day after I testified before the California State Assembly. SeaWorld put out a self-filmed, produced, whatever you want to call it, segment where they had Wendy lie about my injury, my facial injury the way I got it was doing a fast foot push on Corky in a show. She's 8,200 pounds. And she said absolutely no whale was involved. He just ran and dove into the shallow area of the pool. And then she also put our friendship in past tense. And that was the first time that she didn't even give me the decency to at least say that to me first. I had to hear of it and watch it in a SeaWorld produced segment. So that one hurt me. And you know what? And I had to accept it. At first, I was like angry, and then I was like, "No, I'm not going to say that that hurt me. I'm not going to let that." And then I'm like, "No, you know what? That's okay that that hurt me. Just remember that, and remember this experience. Remember why you're doing it. You're going to suffer hits by speaking out, and I knew that. So I'm not naive to that. I knew what I was getting into when I did this, but they're not going to stop me. They can keep trying all they want. I'm still going to keep speaking the truth about the whales and what happened while I was there." Right.
And I guess they don't have a gag order on you because you don't work there anymore and you didn't settle.
That's right.
So you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is John Hargrove, the former SeaWorld trainer featured prominently in the documentary film Blackfish, who is discussing why he believes whales should not be kept in captivity. So again, there are a lot of questions, and obviously it's a big issue. I mean, one of them that hasn't come up very much to the fore is that there are also bottlenose dolphins, one of the questions here, and it relates actually to several. And so it kind of, there is this ethical, moral dilemma. If you go to a zoo or you go to an aquarium, when is it okay and not okay to keep an animal in captivity? And you know, there have been whole conferences. I don't expect you to answer that. But what about the bottlenose dolphins? And is there some kind of criteria that where you drew the line?
The easy line to draw is animals in captivity for entertainment. I mean, I think that's just vile. I mean, really? I mean, that's just something like for like a throwback in time, that like a court jester or something, like, you know, sitting there like a king on your throne and having some poor slave like entertain you with tricks. I mean, that's the way I view it, really. So I mean, all animals in captivity for entertainment should be a thing of the past. I do think there are good zoological institutions out there. There have to be, and I'm saying I think. I can't name one off the top of my head, but I haven't done that because I just haven't done my research on it. But there have to be that are really truly doing positive things to conserve a species. SeaWorld is not one of them. But you know, I would just say there's probably four simple questions you could ask before you wanted to visit a zoo. Ask, you know, what animals do you have in your zoo? Why do you have them? Is there a need to have them? Are they endangered? What do you do with surplus animals? Because we've, you know, all that, those horror stories surfaced at, like last year, I think, like in Denmark and then another country. So they would have these animals, that have them breed, and because they didn't have the space, then they would just kill one. Even when other zoos would volunteer, like, look, we'll take them, we have the space, and they would kill them anyway. So, I mean, obviously, these are places that you should not visit, you know. So, you know, I would just say, if you want to go to a zoo, call them up, ask them, you know, do you have any animals that in your zoo that are not endangered? And if they say, well, blah, 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 then ask them why. Ask them those questions, get to the bottom of it, and then make an informed decision. You could probably bust that out in 15 minutes.
Okay.
And then let me know which ones are good and bad.
So, great. That's a good response. And being associated with aquariums myself, I study animals in the wild, but some animals lend themselves well to captivity, and yeah, they're not, you know, Bozo the Clown or doing anything that's indignant to the animal, I think. You know, I mean, some of these things are crazy, but yeah. In other respects, it's beautiful to see an animal, and obviously an orca inspired you as a six-year-old and inspired you to do what you did, and I think there is that education value, but there is an ethical and moral line, and it is a bit of a, well, it's a much longer conversation than we can have here. But so there are four here that are very similar again, and you've been involved with legislation in trying to create a solution. I'm not sure if you're saying shut SeaWorld down, but definitely the orca entertainment or whatever, dine with Shamu kind of thing. I visited SeaWorld this year as kind of an experiment with students who had not seen Blackfish and who had never been to SeaWorld. And a liberal arts college in San Francisco, it's like trying to find an honest man and someone who's never heard of the issue, which is great for us, but the whole world is not like that. But they were instantly appalled by the whole like circus atmosphere. So people want to know, well, what would happen with this law that Assemblyman Bloom is introducing, or it's actually been shelved, I think, until next year, until there's stronger support. But What happens? Do you let them go? What's happened in the past with other orca wild or captive orcas that have been released into the wild? What will happen to the orcas here in California or in other states or even nations of captivity?
Well, I think, you know, what people need to realize is that, you know, SeaWorld has a responsibility even when these laws pass. They can't just kill off their whales or, you know, do something like that. They have, a legal responsibility to try to find that answer. And, you know, I think what we want, well, first of all, you have to stop the breeding program. If you don't stop the breeding program, you're just going to have killer whales in captivity until the end of time. So that has to stop. And let this be the last generation of killer whales in captivity. Then, for what do we do with this last generation? Well, ideally, a sea sanctuary. And when I first started speaking out on Blackfish, I wasn't totally sold on sea sanctuary because I was very much still SeaWorld mindset and SeaWorld focused. But, I've learned a lot from brilliant-minded people in the 2.5 years since I've left SeaWorld, and I know that sea sanctuaries are totally viable. They're totally possible. The right minds are out there. The fact is, we've already done sea pens. We've been doing sea pens since the 70s. So we did sea pens with Keiko, and Keiko, you know, you have some people who will say that was a failure, and you have some people that will say that that was a success. But the fact is that he lived in a sea pen for 4 years and lived free, totally free, outside of CPEN for another year after that. So in my view, after learning that information, I do view that as a success. And that was way back in the 90s. So, we can do this, and now it's even better. We're just going to raise it up to the next end. And then that could be an approximation. We could find whales that could be potentially viable candidates for reintroduction into the wild if their family members were still alive and we could identify them, that we saw them, interacting with these animals. I mean, it's something that you could go for, because I know, like, Lolita at Miami Sea Aquarium, you know, the members of her family are still alive, and they've identified that. But for whales whose families that we don't know where they are, and they're dead, and the animals have been led very sick lives because they've lived in captivity and have a lot of health problems, I mean, we have to take an honest perspective at that and look at, like, those animals will probably always stay in, you know, the care of keepers, trainers, whatever format that person will fall under, in a sea sanctuary for the rest of their life. But at least we will end the practice once this generation is gone, and this, because I really view it as a stain upon humanity that this ever happened in the first place.
Great. So there's only time for one very brief question. What can people do besides sign a petition and maybe not attend SeaWorld? And are there any local groups in the Bay working to protect orcas? And if you don't know, I do.
Good. I'm glad you do, because I need you to tell me those. But, you know, there's so many great organizations that are, I mean, I'm overwhelmed by how many incredible organizations there are out there. And I just got back from the UK for a week, and I was blown away by what Born Free Foundation is doing and World Cetacean Alliance. And I want you to talk about, because you know it better than me, speak about all the great ones here. Rick O'Berry says, and it's so simple and it's so true, just don't buy a ticket. If you don't buy a ticket and you don't go to the park, their stock's going to continue to tank. And then, you know, they're going to be forced to, you know, eventually change their business model, because that's what they're not doing, is they're not changing their business model. But eventually, at some point, they will be forced to change their business model, or someone else with a more creative and visionary mind will come in and take over and do the right thing. So can you tell me all the great groups?
Well, Earth Island Institute, Marine Mammal Project, has been working. Dave Phillips and Mark have been working for decades, and including orcas in captivity. That's one that definitely comes to mind. We're almost out of time, so our thanks to John Hargrove, former whale trainer at SeaWorld, featured in the documentary film Blackfish, which aired last year on CNN, and author of the new book, Beneath the Surface, Killer Whale, SeaWorld, and the Truth Beyond Blackfish. And also thanks to our audience here on radio, television, and the internet.
And we want to remind everyone that John's book is for sale in the reception area, and he'll be pleased to sign books there following the program. And there's nothing better than holding a book in your hand instead of reading it on your pad. So I'm David McGuire, and now this meeting at the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.